after Russia said it would scale back assaults on the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv, its forces continue their bombardment.
Kyiv is fighting, and very heavy fights are next to Kyiv in the Kyiv region. And the city of Chernihiv was held during the whole night.
Plus, the efforts of those in Ukraine to help care for people who can't escape the fighting.
Now I'm very grateful for Sergei and his team's help. They help us, the disabled, a lot. They bring whatever you ask for. They bring water.
And later in the program, the United Nations Refugee Agency says the number of people fleeing the violence has surpassed another milestone. Today is Wednesday, March 30th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. Russian forces continued their bombardment Wednesday after Moscow said it would scale back operations around Kyiv during peace talks in Turkey on Tuesday. Nearly 5 weeks into its invasion, Moscow has failed to capture any major cities. For more on the ground, I spoke with Anna Chernikova in western Ukraine.
The attacks on Kyiv and especially the city of Chernihiv, they increased. From yesterday, so after these assurances from Russia that they will back off from Kyiv and Chernihiv, the opposite thing happened. So Kyiv is fighting, and very heavy fights are next to Kyiv in the Kyiv region. And the city of Chernihiv was held during the whole night. You know, there is no sign of any de-escalation so far. Probably they tried to regroup, or they are trying to regroup the Russian forces, I mean, but there is no sign for de-escalation so far.
Anna, what has been the response by the Ukrainian government? After all, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky came out on Tuesday evening saying that he was very wary of those Russian assurances made in Turkey on Tuesday.
President Zelensky said in the evening in his speech to the public that any negotiation should be, you know, should be a reason to stop fighting and to just, you know, relax. So basically, the position of government is that the most important what is happening right now is at the battlefield. And any negotiation at one moment, obviously will lead to a certain deal. But this deal and, you know, the context of this deal will rely a lot on what is happening on the battlefield. So the main thing now is to fight, to protect, and to, you know, to be even more successful on the battlefield.
And I wanted to ask you about the humanitarian situation in Ukraine. The United Nations has said that well over 10 million people have been forced to flee the fighting. Over 4 million have fled Ukraine itself, leaving 6 million internally displaced. But for those who cannot get out of the country, who are either trapped in cities like Mariupol or elsewhere, who can't move, what is the situation for them? What are they struggling with?
Yes, in certain areas, it's quite difficult for the regions to handle that much people. If we talk about the western part of Ukraine, it's a bit easier because there are borders with the European Union and with European countries, and obviously all the products and medications is much easier to get and to import. If we talk about Dnipro, for example, because a lot of people from Kharkiv region, they move now to Dnipro, the situation is much more difficult. But still, there is no situation that people are starving or anything like that. But again, we have to see, because obviously there are more and more people who are internally displaced, and Western regions are doing an extremely great job of how they share everything they have, and how volunteers bring all the needed products from west to eastern part and to central part.
Anna Chernikova is continuing to report for us from western Ukraine. Anna, thank you very much, and please be safe.
Thank you.
Wednesday, China's foreign ministry spokesperson Wang Wenbin urged the continuation of efforts by the international community to promote the talks between Russia and Ukraine toward resolving the conflict and establishing peace. But Moscow signaled that there were no signs of a breakthrough. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said that while it is positive that Ukraine has written down some of its demands on paper, coming to a resolution was not very promising. He also later added that Russia's position continues to be that Crimea is part of the Russian Federation. Meanwhile, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov is visiting eastern China. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi says that Moscow and Beijing are more determined to develop bilateral ties and boost cooperation. In a statement, Russia says the two also condemned what they called illegal and counterproductive Western sanctions imposed on Moscow over its actions in Ukraine. Russia is looking to China for support and partnerships as it becomes ever more isolated from global financial systems and supply chains. China has refused to condemn Russia's actions in Ukraine or call it an invasion. Now, from Ukraine, Reuters' Rhiannon Oliver brings us this story of volunteers helping those in a city that's been ravaged by Russia's war.
In the besieged Ukrainian city of Kharkiv, so far one of the hardest hit by Russia's invasion of the country, volunteers Maxim and Sergei are helping residents survive by distributing humanitarian aid. Walking through the eastern neighborhood of Kharazont, they hand out food and medicine to those who remain.
People lost their homes, their flats. Many were hit by bombs, by rockets. There is almost no life in the district.
We are here to make sure that not a single person is hungry or dies of starvation. That would be horrible. Apart from this, we help with medicine as much as we can, whatever we can order. Plus, we help the elderly and the bedridden. We deliver personal hygiene products. There are quite a few children and babies in the district. We deliver baby food for them.
Grassroots and self-funded charities have delivered food, medicine, and personal hygiene products to residents who are unable to get humanitarian aid because of old age, disability, or their neighborhood being under regular shelling. Vitaly is one of Kharkiv's residents reliant on the help of volunteers.
I used to help blind people. I organized cultural trips to Kyiv, to theaters, so that people who are blind could widen their knowledge. Now I'm very grateful for Sergei and his team's help. They help us, the disabled, a lot. They bring whatever you ask for. They bring water.
That report from Reuters' Rhiannon Oliver. Michelle Bachelet, addressing the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva, called on Russia to withdraw its troops. She also said that her office had received credible allegations that Russian forces had used cluster munitions in populated areas of Ukraine at least 24 times. And she said her office was investigating the alleged use of cluster munitions by Ukraine. In Washington, a U.S. official confirmed to VOA News, citing recently declassified intelligence, that Russian President Vladimir Putin felt he was misled by advisors who were too scared to tell him how poorly the war in Ukraine has been going and how damaging Western sanctions have been. The official did not provide the intelligence report, but said the information had been declassified. The Kremlin made no immediate comment after the end of the working day in Moscow, and the Russian embassy in Washington did not immediately reply to a request for comment from Reuters News. Also, U.S. President Joe Biden spoke with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky Wednesday morning. According to a White House readout, the leaders discussed how the United States is working around the clock to fulfill the main security assistance requests by Ukraine, the critical effects those weapons are having, and the continued efforts to identify additional capabilities to help Ukrainian defense forces. In addition, President Biden informed President Zelensky that the U.S. intends to provide $500 million in direct budgetary aid. As already mentioned, Russian forces fired upon Kyiv and other cities throughout the night. On Tuesday, Pentagon spokesperson John Kirby said the U.S. had detected small numbers of Russian ground forces moving away from the Kyiv area, but it appeared to be a repositioning of forces and not a real withdrawal.
That the Russians themselves have said, in the same breath they're saying they're withdrawing, that they're reprioritizing the Donbas area, eastern Ukraine.
For more on the latest assessment of Russian troops in Ukraine and more, I spoke with VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb.
Well, there's some real skepticism in this building at the Pentagon about Russia's declaration that it was going to hold back, like you said. And we've seen that. We've seen these cities that they've said that they're going to pull away from. We've seen them be shelled. Now, what we also are seeing is a refocus on the east. We've seen the people, the military units that have pulled back from Kyiv, they appear to be going back up to Belarus to resupply with what the Pentagon thinks may be a repositioning to the east to try to cut off the Donbas area or try to make some sort of a land bridge between Donbas, which is over in the east, and the Crimean Peninsula, which Russia annexed back in 2014. And this is a way for Russia, in a sense, to save face, because Russia clearly has not been gaining. They've been stopped and stalled in all of the major population areas, especially Kyiv. They have not been able to get it. And so, you know, Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby said no amount of, quote, spin can mask what the world has seen in Ukraine. And he pointed to the courage and the military prowess of Ukraine's armed forces in preventing Russia from occupying these areas that many thought that Russia, this big, huge superpower, would be able to occupy relatively quickly.
Carla, the United States, as well as NATO, have greatly increased their troop presence in the areas closer to Russia. Can you share a little bit about what the United States' additional troops are doing in Europe?
So the U.S. has significantly increased their presence across Europe. You know, we were looking at around 80,000 troops covering Europe and also in Europe for U.S. Africa Command, because that's based in Europe too. And that has increased now since the Russian aggression. That has increased to more than 100,000. The European Command head, General Todd Walters, was saying on Capitol Hill today, he said that we're watching this huge historic demonstration of unity with NATO. And when it comes to a permanent U.S. presence, the U.S. needs to see what NATO wants to do and then fill in the gaps. And he was specifically asked, well, what about going from a rotational force to a permanent force? And he told a member of Congress that, yeah, that's got to change, implying that maybe more permanent presence is needed on the eastern flank of NATO by the U.S.
Reporting from the Pentagon, VOA's Carla Babb. Carla, thank you very much.
Okay, no problem. Thanks a lot.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. Dustin Carnahan, assistant professor in the Department of Communication and the College of Communication Arts and Sciences at Michigan State University, discusses propaganda and its role in the war in Ukraine with the Associated Press.
I think there are two central objectives to the sorts of propaganda and disinformation campaigns that we're seeing come from Russia during the current conflict with Ukraine. I think the first objective is to try to shore up support for the Kremlin in Russia. This is a common tactic that has been used by Putin and the Russians for several decades now, where they're advancing oftentimes false or misleading narratives about what's happening both within their country and outside of their country in order to shore up support for Putin and the Communist Party. The second objective is to try to use propaganda and disinformation in order to justify their invasion of Ukraine. I think you saw this in the early days of the conflict and even just prior to it, where there were accusations that Ukraine was being run by neo-Nazis and drug addicts. We've seen those sorts of allegations evolve here rather recently, where now there's concern that the Russians will start advancing the case that the Ukrainians had chemical weapons, which is leading to, for example, allegations of false flag operations on the part of the Ukrainians, that they are engaging in these sorts of actions against their own civilians to generate wider international support for their defense of the invasion of Russia. There's absolutely no foundation for that sort of accusation, but the fact that you could see these sorts of conspiracies rise that now move beyond just our beliefs about what's happening domestically, but our beliefs about what's happening abroad and in really important military conflict zones that have enormous implications for our national security. You tend to see these sorts of propaganda techniques, these disinformation campaigns, in order to try to create some sort of support for their invasion in the world community.
He adds that Russia is manifesting these strategies in two ways.
First off, are the active communication efforts on the part of the Russians to try to present themselves as engaging in a just war, that this was necessary and important for the national security interest of Russians. But then you see this on the other side, where it's not so much advancing actively propaganda, but it's restricting alternative perspectives from being able to enter the country. Recently, we've seen Russia engage in a sort of media crackdown that we haven't seen since the Cold War, restricting access to specific television stations and online outlets. For example, currently in Russia, Facebook is unavailable to my knowledge. And so as a consequence of that, there's kind of a two-pronged war, both advancing the official narrative as well as restricting any alternative narratives from being able to enter the country.
Michigan State University professor Dustin Carnahan. The United Nations says the number of people fleeing Ukraine has reached another milestone. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma is up next.
The UN Refugee Agency says more than 4 million have now fled Ukraine following Russia's invasion, a new milestone in the largest refugee crisis in Europe since World War II. Of those, 2.3 million have entered Poland. Aid workers say the flow has eased in recent days as many people await developments in the war. An estimated 6.5 million people have also been displaced from their homes within Ukraine. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Russia's invasion of Ukraine is bringing the European Union together in ways it never was before. Not just its leaders, but also ordinary Europeans. But that's not always been the case. Lisa Bryan looks at what this means for the EU and whether this unity can last.
Another rally for Ukraine here at the Place de la République in Paris, one of hundreds across Europe these days. Alongside Ukrainian and other national flags, there are also some European Union ones. People here say they are proud to be EU citizens.
There were people in Kyiv dying on barricades under European flags. So it's connected. It's very much connected.
For me, l'Europe fait partie de ma culture.
For me, Europe is part of my culture. We have common borders with Belgium, Italy, and Germany. And for me, Europe means peace.
Et avec d'autres pays, tous ces pays m'entourent depuis que je suis né. Et naturellement, pour moi, l'Europe, ça veut dire la paix.
Since Russia invaded Ukraine in February, the 27-member EU has taken some historic decisions, sanctioning Russia, taking in more than 3 million Ukrainian refugees, and collectively sending millions of dollars of military equipment to Ukraine for the first time. Several recent surveys show EU citizens strongly back these and other measures to degrees rarely seen before.
The EU has the capacity to act. And when it has the will to act, it does so. And Europeans feel very positively about this.
That's not always been the case. The EU is often perceived as overly bureaucratic, regulating even the size of some produce, like bananas. European Parliament elections are usually marked by low turnout, especially in countries like France, where Euroscepticism is high. Britain's exit from the EU also sparked calls by other Europeans to do the same. So it seems paradoxical that a war in non-member state Ukraine would fan such strong pro-EU sentiments.
There's a sense that behind the attack on Ukraine, there's also an attack on European values and against democracy. Beyond Ukraine, there's also a fear for the Europeans themselves and for the integrity of the EU and peace in Europe.
Pour la paix en Europe.
Today, Europe and the Ukraine war are key election themes. In Hungary, where Prime Minister Viktor Orban, who has clashed with Brussels and nurtured ties with Russian leader Vladimir Putin, is running a close race against his strongly pro-EU rival, Peter Markizay. And in France, where strongly pro-EU President Emmanuel Macron is running against presidential hopefuls from the far left and right who want fewer or different ties with Brussels. Meanwhile, there seems to be no sign of fading support for Ukraine.
You know, European citizens are doing this for Ukrainians, but they're also doing this because they are afraid of what comes next for them. And so they understand that they need to be on the front line.
This shock of a war on their doorsteps appears to be driving home to EU citizens just how important it is to live in a strong, peaceful, and united Europe. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Opponents of Russia's invasion of Ukraine gathered in the U.S. state of Colorado to raise funds for displaced civilians and to remember those killed by Nazis during World War II. Svetlana Prestinska has our story.
I want to support people to survive through this horrible time. I have my parents, I have my niece in there. I have a lot of friends, which is really like my family. They're very, very close. I would do whatever I can from the bottom of my heart.
Fundraiser visitor Valentino Sati.
I believe this kind of events are very important because help can be sent directly to those people that people who are here know and know their needs.
Fundraising volunteer Mark Dillon says Poland's continuing support for Ukrainians is outstanding.
It's hard to imagine if you have a population in Poland of 34 million and you welcome 2 million people from a neighboring country.
Igor Radchenko moved to Colorado from Ukraine last year. He welcomes Polish support for Ukraine across their common border and here in the United States.
Цей захід, який організували поляки, наші брати, які дуже допомагають Україні. Він дуже чудово, ми дуже захоплені, що так поляки допомагають, організовуючи дружбу. Важливо і для наших людей, які дивляться це в Україні, що вони не кинуть, вони не самі.
Ukrainian-American activists also believe it is important for people to remember what has happened before. They gathered in Denver's Bobby Yar Memorial Park, designed to commemorate the Nazi massacre of Ukrainian Jews and others in Kyiv during World War II. Rabbi Emily Hyatt.
We know what it was like. We say in every generation, we have to remember that it hasn't always been easy. We speak out and show up and send you our love and our prayers. My family comes from Ukraine. If it hadn't been that they left 100 years ago, we deserve to build for our children a place where they don't have to be afraid of this, where they don't have to sleep in basements or bomb shelters.
Irina Shatalov sees parallels between the violence of World War II and the current Russian invasion.
We would like to remind people what doesn't mean Holocaust, what doesn't mean genocide. And right now it happens again in the middle of Europe. People dying, children dying.
Denver City Council member Kendra Black co-hosted the event to help raise awareness about the violence in Ukraine brought on by the Russian invasion. As Ukrainian activists here vowed to keep up their fundraising and their vigils until the country is free. Svetlana Pristinska for VOA News, Denver.
And finally, the International Committee of the Red Cross confirms that one of their warehouses was hit in Mariupol, but they haven't used it since March 15th and did not know if anyone else had. They also added that the organization did not have a team on the ground in Ukraine, so they have no other information on potential casualties or the extent of the damage. Also, Britain put in place new legal powers on Wednesday to prohibit maintenance on aircraft and ships belonging to specific sanctioned Russian oligarchs or their businesses. The new legislation took effect at 1600 UTC and prohibits maintenance on aircraft or ships belonging to specific sanctioned Russian oligarchs or their businesses. The measures complement those already imposed by Britain and other states, as well as commercial decisions already being taken place by key industry players. Plane makers Boeing and Airbus have already halted supplies of components to Russia, and the United States as well as the European Union have imposed sanctions on Russian aviation. Well, that's going to do it for us today. Be sure to stay up to date with continuing coverage not only on Ukraine, but news and events from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com. You can also find additional updates on our social media platforms. Just be sure to follow at VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.